prime minister and had therefore had real weight around the cabinet table. But I think some of the initial noises that Steve has made, particularly about trying to get house building going in London, where the numbers are catastrophically bad at the moment, have encouraged them. So I think time will tell. And I think there's also been some relief that the housing minister, who sits below the Secretary of State, either Angela or Steve, Matthew Pennycook, has stayed in his job, because we've had appalling turnover in that role over the last 10 years or so. So having some stability there, I think, will be widely welcomed across the sector.
That was Lord Barwell, Gavin Barwell, the former Conservative Minister for Housing and Chief of Staff at Number 10. That's it from me today. Daniel Finkelstein on The Times at 1. My producer was Lizzie Highfield. My technical operator was James Wally. And next on Times Radio, you'll be pleased to welcome Fee Glover and Jane Garvey.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, this is Jane Garvey between now and 4 o'clock here on Times Radio. More questions for Prince Andrew and the palace ahead of the publication of Virginia Giuffre's memoir. We'll have the latest on an internet outage which saw Zoom and Wordle go offline. And could migrants training British workers be the key to taking back control of our borders? Let's get the news at 2 first from Cara Bentley.
It's actually Andy Hayes. Good afternoon. Amazon says most services affected by problems with its cloud computing software are working normally again. Concerns were reported with several apps and websites, including Zoom, some banks and HMRC. Global security advisor Jake Moores told Times Radio it doesn't appear to be a cyber attack.
Obviously, it can never be completely ruled out, although if it were a cyber attack, I would suggest that it would have pointed those websites to another site, say, for example, a criminal website to make people aware of it. In this case, we're just seeing them not work. So it's unlikely, but of course, it has to be part of the investigation afterwards.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has met Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff in Israel this morning. J.D. Vance is expected to join them tomorrow. Trump says the ceasefire is still in place despite the fighting yesterday. Two IDF soldiers were killed. Government spokeswoman Shosh Bedrosian has given this update.
Major Yaniv Kula was just 26 years old and from Modi'in. He fell in battle in southern Gaza. He was laid to rest this morning in Jerusalem. Also, Staff Sergeant Itai Yavetz was just 21 years old and also from Modi'in. He too fell in battle yesterday in the same incident in the southern part of Gaza. He will be laid to rest this afternoon in Modi'in.
Here, the King has visited the site of the synagogue attack in Manchester. He was led past floral tributes outside Heaton Park Hebrew Congregation in Crumpsall. Two people were killed after Jihad al-Shami carried out the attack on October the 2nd. England's chief medical officer has said children were forced to spend too much time indoors during the pandemic. Sir Chris Whitty says it had a harmful effect on them. From late March 2020, people were ordered to stay home and only leave for food shopping, work and exercise. Sir Chris has told the COVID inquiry there should have been a more liberal approach, but he insists schools closures were needed to prevent further deaths.
What I am confident about saying is that had schools not closed, and based on the evidence we had at the time, the peak of the pandemic would have been higher, and that would have had, obviously, direct effect from deaths from COVID in the first wave.
The son of former England footballer Stuart Pearce has been killed in a tractor crash. 21-year-old Harley Pearce is believed to have lost control of the vehicle in Gloucestershire on Thursday. His sister Chelsea says he was a golden boy with an infectious smile. And former DUP leader Sir Geoffrey Donaldson's sex offences trial has been delayed for a second time because of his wife's health. He denies the 18 alleged offences, while his wife Eleanor denies aiding and abetting. It's now expected to be held next year, having already been delayed from March to November the 3rd. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB. Online and on your smart speaker. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
A very good afternoon, and apologies first of all. I mean, it's always good to get one in early. That was clearly Andy Hayes and not Cara Bentley, and I do apologise to you, Andy. Sorry about that. This is Jane Garvey. I'm with you until 4 o'clock this afternoon. Fee, not too well today, but very, very hopeful that she'll be back with us tomorrow afternoon. Between now and 4 o'clock then, Andrew What Now? The historian Tessa Dunlop is going to talk to us imminently. We'll talk about the audacious theft at the Louvre, Red Faces in Paris. Is this a national humiliation? One former president thinks the Russians might be involved. Are you a middle-class forager, and what sort of damage are you doing to the environment? I hope you're blushing if you are exactly that. Have successive British governments fuelled anti-immigrant sentiment by allowing the economy to be too reliant on immigrants? That's a topic for us this afternoon. We'll talk to a conflict resolution expert on whether the Israel-Hamas ceasefire will hold. And it really is, let's be honest, it's a very... I'm just looking across the river to the other side of the Thames. It's a dreary old, very autumnal Monday afternoon. But don't despair. Robbie Millen, The Times and Sunday Times literary editor, is here. He's bouncy, he's energetic, he can inform and entertain. And he's going to talk to us after 3.30 this afternoon. This week, Muriel Spark is very much on his mind. And our personal finance guru, Adam Shaw, will discuss pet insurance. Are you and Rover being taken for a ride? That's very important stuff to those of us who are pet lovers, although my own tabby is exceedingly unadventurous and is unlikely to get herself into too much difficulty. Famous last words, but she is insured. Don't worry about her. We'll talk to Tessa Dunlop in a moment. The most read stories on the Times website this afternoon. At number three, Prince Andrew rejected free embassy stays for expensive hotels. The former trade envoy, Paul Scully, has spoken about the prince's travel arrangements. We'll talk more on that subject very soon. The second most read story, Trump tells Zelensky to cede land to Russia in a shouting match. The US president reportedly berated Ukraine's leader and echoed Russian talking points during a meeting at the White House. And the most read piece on the Times website is Amazon, Snapchat and Ring are in recovery, we're told, after AWS went down. This is the Times live page where you can get the very latest on the big online outage caused by Amazon Web Services going down. Our tech guru, Chris Stokel-Walker, is standing by and he's on the programme before 2.30 to explain all. Now, you can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need your digital subscription. If you don't have one, it's very easy to get one. Just go to thetimes.com/subscribe. And please do contact me this afternoon on 0333 003 2353. If anything is on your mind, I am really interested in what you think about Andrew, whether you would like him to be cast out altogether, whether you have questions of your own. And it is just worth saying that Amy Wallace is our guest on the programme tomorrow afternoon. She is the woman who helped Virginia Giuffre write her memoir, Nobody's Child, which is officially published tomorrow. I have had a preview copy and I've read it, and I have to say it's one of the most upsetting memoirs I think I've ever read. And Amy Wallace, of course, is able to speak about it in the absence of Virginia Giuffre, who took her own life, very sadly, after battling really severe mental and physical health problems in the later years of her incredibly troubled life. So Amy Wallace with us on the programme tomorrow. So Prince Andrew gave up his royal titles on Friday, but there are more questions surrounding him. The Met is looking into claims that Andrew asked one of its officers to try to get hold of personal information about Virginia Giuffre, whose memoir will be published tomorrow. We're going to talk to its ghostwriter on the programme. That's twice I've told you about that now. Let's bring in Tessa Dunlop, royal historian and author of Elizabeth and Philip. Tessa, this is all tawdry and upsetting stuff, isn't it? What do you think is likely to happen next?
It's deeply upsetting, actually, Jane, and so horribly predictable. And what I think I found most disturbing is the way in which the story has been cast through our own mass media. I went to bed on Friday night and Andrew's interview with Emily Maitlis was still being referred to as car crash interview, i.e. terrible for Andrew's image. We're somehow still telling this story from his perspective. It's extraordinary. And then all this discussion about him saving the blushes of the royal family. If you look at that photograph, the infamous photograph with the prince, age 41, and the vulnerable child, age 17, in jeans that she so carefully selected to look like Britney Spears. Nobody's Girl, I thought, was the most, I agree with you, spellbindingly dark retelling of a very sorry, sad life. Rest in peace, Virginia. So she, in that picture, has taken her own life. The individual taking the picture, Jeffrey Epstein, has taken his own life. Ghislaine Maxwell is in prison, the only man walking free, unencumbered, voluntarily giving up his Duke title at the weekend to save his brother's blushes, is Prince Andrew. And this entire saga speaks to a made in Great Britain problem, which is the untouchability of the royal family.
Yes, I mean, you have to say, even those of us, I would put myself as a kind of, how would I describe it, a sort of lukewarm monarchist, somebody who believes that there are some decent people in the royal family. And you look at other examples of how other countries do their business and you think, actually, the soft power, it sort of works, let's leave them there. But my goodness, all this is real fuel to those people who believe the monarchy is just a busted flush and has to go.
We desperately need to do more to protect our monarchy. This morning, I was hearing, and I'm a light monarchist light, for want of a better expression. I was listening to Bridget Phillipson, the government minister, on the BBC this morning, saying whether there is an amendment to an Act of Parliament to ensure that the Duke's title isn't just put in abeyance, but is actually taken from him. At the moment, you can give and take honours. I'm thinking Nicolae Ceaușescu, Robert Mugabe, the late Jimmy Savile all had their honours removed. But you can't with titles at the moment. That would require an act of law. It's just a voluntary gesture at the moment from the Duke. And she said this was up to the King. The King had to lead it. At which point you have to ask, which institutions, you know, entirely police themselves. Mm. I think the King could do with some help. We are talking about his brother here. I think this needs governmental leadership, actually.
Well, politicians are always incredibly squeamish about involving themselves in regal matters, aren't they? And in fact, it's been very, very difficult for MPs, for example, to bring up the Andrew issue in the Commons. In fact, I'm not sure it's happened at all, has it?
Well, there's several reasons for that. It's a convention that you don't table questions about the royal family on the floor of the House of Parliament. Just if I may quote the former Tory Chancellor, Ken Clark. He once said, most politicians are so in awe of the royal family that expressions of displeasure from the palace about issues directly bearing on the family can usually produce quite significant policy shifts. We also, of course, Jane, see it within our own trade, journalism. I'm actually in Romania talking to you from Bucharest at the moment, and I thought I was going to have a weekend away from this disgusting story. I feel like I've literally been trolled on the telephone. You are one of a selected few I've responded to. And I think, well, why can't all the other royal spokespeople talk about this properly? And one of the reasons why they're so encumbered and shackled, and Harry was right here, is because most of them feed from the royal trough. So if they really tell you what they think, that actually the royal family isn't examined, isn't subject to the same transparency rules as the rest of us, is exempt from almost all taxation, particularly if you're the sovereign or the successor to the throne. If they really spoke truth to power in that way, they wouldn't then get the best seats in the house for the next soft scoop on what the Princess of Wales is wearing to Wimbledon.
Okay, I mean, strong stuff, Tessa. And I should speak up for certainly for Roy Nicker and for Kate Mansey, who ply their trade here at News UK and have worked very hard on stories about Prince Andrew. And indeed, it was Kate who revealed that the title of the Duke of York was going at the weekend. But I take your point. These two sides of the royal press equation, they need each other, don't they? But do you think...
They absolutely do.
Yeah. Do you think this is the beginning of something very significant in terms of... I mean, let's just be really... I don't know. Are we talking about potentially the beginning of the end of the British monarchy?
No, I don't think we are. But I think what this has exposed is what you might call an existential crisis for monarchy. There's all sorts of hand-wringing about why he's still in the Royal Lodge. The reason he's in the Royal Lodge is partly because, for example, the King must, by definition, be paying his security, which racks up to millions of pounds. How does the king afford to do that? Well, he's not subject to inheritance tax. We talk about the sovereign grant. It's sort of chick feed, the sovereign grant. How did the queen pay off Andrew to the tune of apparently 12 million? Well, because she gets all the money from the Duchy of Lancaster. William, and I think he's a decent stick, William, despite the fact, you know, he's unaccountable politically. You know those spider memos that we once had fun reading from Prince Charles and The Guardian, yeah, spent years and years trying to get them through into the public domain. We can no longer table Freedom of Information Acts in light of what the sovereign or indeed the Prince of Wales is doing. David Cameron put a stop to that. And the reason we don't really know what Prince Andrew did as an ill-appointed, that was a Tony Blair mistake, by the way, an ill-appointed trade envoy, is because unlike the rest of us, his files have to remain sealed for 105 years after his birth date. Right. Well, just okay, because of his birthright, yeah, he's protected.
Let's just agree then, if it's not the beginning of the end of the monarchy, it's the beginning of the end of that level of absurd secrecy. Prince Andrew does vigorously deny the accusations against him. Indeed, his statement on Thursday, or Friday, forgive me, it was rather typical of the man. He was still pretending to be something he clearly, well, almost clearly to me anyway, isn't. And there still wasn't a hint of any kind of apology or acknowledgement.
And he speaks to his generation, to his class, to his level of entitlement, where he seems unaware of the havoc that his actions have wreaked. It's extraordinary, but it's also horribly predictable. And the pitiful thing about Andrew is he is, if you like, yes, a rotten apple, for want of a better euphemism, but he's a product of the system. And if we want to future-proof the monarchy, make sure this doesn't happen again, we have to insist on higher levels of transparency. And we have to ask questions as to why the beloved Charles, and I'm very fond of the avuncular Charles, who toils on late into his eighth decade, I think actually we have to ask how come he's ended up being the richest, bonkers level richest monarch in modern times. And that's because our tax system means he's got extraordinary levels of cash. So problems like Andrew can literally be swept under the carpet, and it can't continue. Yeah.
Except, of course, it hasn't been, has it? That's why we're sitting here having this conversation right now. And I'm just looking at the screens, and you're right. The king isn't well. We know he's not well. And he's gone, as he should have done, to the synagogue in Manchester today to pay his respects. But the truth is, there'll be a few photographs of that event in the papers tomorrow. But the Andrew story will still be the big one. And that problem is not going away. So what would you like to see happen, Tessa, over the next couple of days and weeks?
I think I heard one royal correspondent saying, you know, they kind of wanted King Charles to make some kind of statement acknowledging Virginia Giuffre's pain, etc. I mean, it's pie in the sky stuff. I think we can't expect the old king to take leadership in that way, in a way that exposes his brother. By all accounts, you know, the queen asked Charles to look out for Andrew in a sort of pastoral sense. I think it has to come from government. I think a start would be to look at this act last amended in 1917 to ensure that you could sever the titles of royals who were fighting against the British state. We could insert just a few lines to ensure that if awful things happen like this ghastly debacle, then you horrific. I mean, so dark. As you've read that memoir, I've got to say, I was just kind of moved to tears by it. And as an oral historian who works with the testimony of women who are remembering back to their teenage years in World War II, I find it a wholly credible account. The fascinating small details that she remembered, the piecing together of this story where she becomes really a pawn at the hands of these men who are almost blind to the damage that they're doing. We can't expect the king to own that kind of stuff on behalf of his brother. I think, no, that we need to see the act amended once and for all, and that would be a really good start. And then I think we need to ask questions about why that the royal family are exempt from scrutiny when it comes to their public work. And we need to look at questions of transparency. It's worth bearing in mind, Prince of Wales and the King are some of the biggest business owners and landowners in the country, and yet they're not subject to the levels of scrutiny they need to be given their access to politicians.
Really interesting to talk to you. Thank you very much, Tessa. Really appreciate you coming on the programme this afternoon. So there we are. That's Tessa Dunlop, historian, pretty forthright in her opinions. 18 minutes past two. What about this from Peter? Removing secrecy from the monarchy will be the beginning of the end. Their ordinariness and greed will be revealed. Peter's in Bury St Edmunds. Victoria says, I think you're being a bit unfair on the monarchy. One bad apple shouldn't spoil the whole bunch. There are many good apples in this family who do a great deal of good for our country. They are the people in the very highest and harshest spotlight. Some compassion, please, for the ones who are enduring very dirty linen being washed in public. And from Paul in Edinburgh, good afternoon. I am generally pro the royals, but the Andrew saga is shocking. The best case scenario is that he's a serial liar. The worst is just truly awful. We should say that he continues to deny all the allegations against him. The number, the WhatsApp number is 0333 003 2353, and we have mentioned Virginia Giuffre's memoir Nobody's Child, which is officially published tomorrow. Some people in the media have had copies. I did read it over the last couple of days, and Tessa has read it too, and as she said, it's really, really sad stuff. And the woman who helped Virginia Giuffre write that book, Amy Wallace, is on the programme tomorrow afternoon. So to a major tech issue today affecting, well, Duolingo for a start. There was a major internet outage which disrupted many of the world's biggest websites and apps. Snapchat, Zoom, Roblox and several banks were all hit by a problem with Amazon Web Services, who now say they are seeing significant signs of recovery. Chris Stokel-Walker normally joins us on a Wednesday, but good to have his company this afternoon. He is our resident tech specialist. Chris, what went on here exactly?
Yeah, afternoon, Jane. I've been broken out of my box. Yes, I think that we've basically seen a catastrophic outage that is affecting millions of people, in part because of a very, very small problem. So AWS, which is Amazon Web Services, they host cloud infrastructure for around about a third of the entire market. The other two big names in this space are Google and Microsoft, who collectively between those two hold around about another third of the market. AWS has had an issue with what's called the domain name system. Now, the DNS, as it's called, is basically the thing that translates times.radio that you put into your web browser, into a series of numbers, the internet protocol address that directs you to that website. So when that goes down, suddenly we start to see these big issues that we've encountered, as you mentioned.
And that's why I couldn't listen to Times Radio on the app this morning.
Yes, exactly. And that is one of the problems. So it's not just your web browser, but it's the apps, the services, everything that underpins them. They tend to use the same URLs, the web addresses with text rather than the numbers. And so that means that basically anything that relied on that seems to have had this big problem of not being able to actually service anything.
I need to say, it's just been bawled at me in my headphones, almost deafening me, woman of my age, by Hugo, the producer. The Times Radio app is very much up and running, so you can listen to it now. I happened to be in a taxi at about 9 o'clock this morning. Couldn't hear a thing. Driving me up the wall. So this shouldn't happen. Why has it, Chris? And are questions being asked? Who's in the line of fire here?
Yeah, lots of questions are being asked. We don't truthfully know exactly why it happened yet, Jane. All we know is that there has been this misconfiguration issue with the DNS system, and then that has cascaded down throughout the internet's infrastructure. If I was a betting man, and you know that I am not really a betting man, but I would bet largely that this is just a simple error, either in terms of a human has misconfigured something, they've put a wrong keystroke in, or there has been an update that hasn't quite worked out internally. Now, the problem here is, and many of the listeners might be thinking, well, why is this impacting me in the UK if this is an outage in the United States? Yeah. This was a problem only in North Virginia. But actually, the issue is that Amazon's services are used globally. And so while maybe if you had issues with HMRC's website, which many people did these days, your HMRC might not be serviced through Amazon's American arm, but actually some of the third-party components that they use, from anything could be from rendering the fonts on the web page to processing the payments, they might connect to that American network, and therefore that is where the issue lies.
And it's not likely to reoccur in the near future.
Well, you say that. I'm not entirely certain. We have had issues previously with AWS. Happened in 2023, happened in 2021, happened in 2020. From where I'm based in Newcastle, that's almost as frequently as buses. So I would imagine that will happen in the next couple of years as well. And you know, it's a case of when this happens, not if. In many ways, AWS and their likes are victims of their own success. They are usually so reliable, so good, so constantly online, that when things do go wrong, they go catastrophically wrong, in large part because of that massive market concentration.
Chris, always good to talk to you and get your input. Thank you very much indeed. Our tech journalist, Chris Stokel-Walker. Hope everybody's absolutely in the picture now. Next on Times Radio, we're going to go to Paris, where some of the French crown jewels were pinched yesterday from the Louvre. Quite an extraordinary story. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The State of It is the new podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Join political heavyweights Stephen Swinford, Caroline Wheeler, Gabriel Pogrand and Patrick Maguire.
This very important geopolitical decision hinged on a guy in a cupboard with nil intercession by anybody.
No party loyalty, just the inside track on the decisions and policymakers that shape your life. The State of It is available to listen now on the Times Radio app or from your preferred podcast provider.
Stop. Listen. Chicken. The 10 mini fillet bucket. $7.99. 10 succulent mini fillets. Buy. Eat. Digest. Good. Repeat. Get the deal. Believe in chicken. KFC. Until 9th of November, subject to availability, participating restaurants only, excludes delivery. Full T's and C's at kfc.co.uk.
Stayshore. What is Stayshore? Stayshore is not just the UK's favourite travel insurance. Stayshore is the confidence that comes with knowing that you're covered by the company with more five-star reviews on Trustpilot than any other provider. A company that welcomes people of all ages with pre-existing medical conditions for single or multiple trips. So Stayshore with Stayshore Travel Insurance. UK's favourite relates to number of five-star Trustpilot reviews, T's and C's and verifications at stayshore.co.uk/reviews.
They're bubbly. They're fuzzy. And they're ruddy delicious!
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees, conditions apply.
This year, Amazon are increasing the electric delivery vehicles we use across Europe to 10,000. It's a difference you'll notice on your doorstep, where babies are made a fuss of, where we deliver footballs for kids' kickabouts, and where they deliver the football straight into next door's garden. Can they have their ball back, please? We're delivering change where it matters, on your doorstep. Delivery service partner vehicles across the UK and EU.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Thanks for your messages this afternoon. This is Josh, who says, I think it's really important we don't tar the whole of the royal family with the same brush based on Andrew's alleged misdeeds. I've met Princess Anne twice in a civic, not social capacity, and a more lovely, grounded and hard-working soul I've never met. And before we become too pious, which family doesn't have an embarrassing oddball in the club? You can't fire somebody from a family. He owns and should be held accountable for his alleged behaviour. Josh, thank you very much for that. We really want to hear from you on this because this story is going nowhere. Chris says Andrew may be a bad egg, but let's not forget his Falklands record. But his sister, the Princess Royal, is worth her weight in gold. Yes, you'll always get people prepared to speak up for the Princess Royal. I absolutely get that because she is indefatigable and incredibly hardworking. Let's go to France. The Louvre still shut after yesterday's break-in. Thousands of visitors have been turned away. Some people in France are viewing this as a national humiliation. Let's talk to journalist Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, who's in Paris. So is that how people are seeing this, Anne-Elisabeth? It's just humiliating for everybody.
I think, I mean, there's a bit of posturing, especially among politicians, but there's also the fact that there's the, I mean, part of the political crisis that we have in France right now has got to do with the fact that we pay lots of taxes in France, but we expected good public services. And this is yet another instance of something that we expected would be running fine, and which is in which, you know, one of the greatest museums in the world, so great culture, important in politics in France. And we apparently cannot manage security in that, just as our outcomes in the education system or in the hospital system have become worse. It's part of a more general disenchantment with the state the country has run.
So are there any developments at all? Any idea who did this?
Well, we have them on camera because there were lots of security cameras. And what is surrealistic is you see them, they came in on that cherry picker, opened the window, got into the gallery, which is a grand gallery. You know, it was the forerunner of the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles. And they literally sort of take stuff from glass cases among tourists who are already there. And nobody seems to bat an eyelid. And it took 7 minutes, but still.
Yes, I must admit, surely other people in the room understood what was happening and knew that it couldn't possibly be right. Or were they simply petrified?
To be honest, I do not know. I mean, the one person they found for an interview just said, I didn't realise what was going on. It could have been somebody sort of fixing something. It's but you know, your guess is as good as mine on this one.
Yes, and the things that have been taken, well, priceless doesn't really begin to cover it.
No, this is, it's nine pieces, but one they dropped, and it was the coronet of Empress Eugenie, and it's an extraordinary sort of, you know, between a crown and a tiara. But you've got another tiara, you've got an amazing emerald necklace, you've got bracelets, and they all belong to members of Bonaparte's family. Queen Hortense was, for instance, I think she was the Queen of Naples, but she was the sister of Bonaparte, and her son, of course, became Napoleon III, the nephew of Bonaparte. So some of the jewellery was actually given to Napoleon by his sisters when he was reigning. But Napoleon III, from a small boy who was the nephew of a man who was in an island in the Pacific, in the South Atlantic, became the Emperor of France, a sort of constitutional monarch who in many ways contributed to the modernity of France in the second half of the 19th century. And he gave his beloved wife, Eugenie of Montijo, a Spaniard, some extraordinary jewellery, and that's part of that that's been stolen.
Yes, I mean, that extraordinary jewellery could be anywhere in the world, I guess, by now. Presumably it'll be broken up, which is horrific, really, when you think about the heritage here.
We can't say that it will be broken up because, you know, the experts know exactly what stones are in those pieces, and the cut of those stones is also very typical of the early to mid-19th century. And they don't cut diamonds or emeralds like that anymore. The shape of the stones is important. You've got those teardrop emeralds in one of the necklaces, etc. So if you recut, you withdraw so much value from the stones that what is the point?
But then, I mean, everyone's just boggled as to who could possibly buy them. I mean, it's not like you can shuffle into a pub and ask somebody in the snug whether they fancy some of these things.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, there's always the story of the mysterious collector who just wants to sort of be inside a vault and look at them on his own. But there are very few of those.
Yes, and let's keep it that way. Anne Elizabeth Moutet, fascinating. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Jane.
Lovely to talk to you. That's Anne Elizabeth in Paris, where we normally go these days to talk about political matters, and they aren't resolved either, but they've got more to deal with in Paris at the moment. Now, this is Jane Garvey on Times Radio, and coming up, the sentencing of an American fraudster discovered living in Glasgow. You might well know a little bit about the story of Nicholas Rossi. And is it actually better and safer to buy from a supermarket than to go foraging? Let's have the latest news headlines just after 2:30. Here's Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Blind people have been able to read again after having a tiny microchip inserted in the back of their eyeball. Patients who were previously living in darkness took part in a trial with a team at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London. They can now recognise faces, do crosswords and read books. Amazon Web Services says the underlying problem that caused many websites to go down this morning is now fixed, but there is still a backlog, meaning some connections could take longer than normal. The UK government's gateway services were affected, along with multiple banks. Tech journalist Chris Stoker-Walker says it could happen again.
We have had issues previously with AWS, happened in 2023, happened in 2021, happened in 2020 from where I'm based in Newcastle. That's almost as frequently as buses. So I would imagine that will happen in the next couple of years as well. And it's a case of when this happens, not if. In many ways, AWS and their likes are victims of their own success. They are usually so reliable, so good, so constantly online, that when things do go wrong, they go catastrophically wrong, in large part because of that massive market concentration.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has met Donald Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and US Special Envoy Steve Witkoff in Israel today. Israeli government spokesman Shosh Bedrosian says they discussed developments and updates. Trump says the ceasefire is still in place despite the fighting yesterday in which two IDF soldiers were killed in southern Gaza. And for a roundup of the news on demand, find the Times News briefing on the Times radio app.
This is Times Radio.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we have been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking. Exploring the world in comfort.
Okay, James, I need you to do a few more drops than yesterday, I'm afraid.
Carl needs to find another driver for his expanding courier business. Someone who will really help to lighten the load.
Any issues, give me a call.
Indeed can help him find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do.
South today, what about you?
Indeed helps you quickly attract, screen, and virtually interview great candidates, all through an easy-to-use dashboard. To start hiring, visit indeed.com/try today.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Get a first look at tomorrow morning's front pages. Tonight from 10 with Carol Walker on Times Radio.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens. 8 new kitchen styles now available, with prices starting from under £3,000. Whether you choose dusky pink, hazy blue, or one of the other new styles, you'll be delighted with your kitchen transformation. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
Good afternoon. It is 24 minutes. It's not 3 o'clock and it's not 2:30. John Pienaar is here with news of his programme between 4 o'clock and 7. At least I can get that right. What have you got, John?
So, a lot to talk about. We've got, obviously, the Middle East. We have Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff in Israel now. The point of the visit was to sort of take on the peace process, but the first stage is still looking shaky. The ceasefire bit, which seemed the simple bit. So I'm going to be looking at what they can do. What can they really achieve there? How fragile is this ceasefire? Where might it go wrong? Where might it go right? Aaron David Miller, formerly of the State Department, is with me. He's one of the best commentators on this thing. He's been at the heart of it for so very long. Bit of a chat about Prince Andrew. I'm talking, among others, to a former head of royalty protection at the Metropolitan Police. I wonder how that job works if you happen to be looking after Prince Andrew. Also, the former Home Secretary, Jackie Smith, who's now a minister in Keir Starmer's government. Lots to talk to her about. And an expert on art theft, his name's Anthony Amore. He used to be the chief investigator, well, still is, actually, the head of security in Boston at the Isabella Stewart, but he knows the Louvre. And I am wondering now a bit, what on earth do you do with a royal Napoleonic crown if you can find a way to half-inch one of those things and all the necklaces and stuff that go with it?
Do you think they're panicking down at the Tower of London a little bit?
Maybe it's better guarded. I mean, those guys just practically walked in up a ladder and took it.
I don't care. And they also had their lorry with the ladder was
already parked up.
It was outside, part of it. And they dropped a crown on the way out.
They just, well, we've all done it, haven't we?
We've all done it.
And I also just, I would like to hear from those, the people who were in the Louvre, in that section of the Louvre, watching it happen. But apparently either not being, perhaps they just thought they were representatives of the museum going about their normal business.
Wearing, I think they were wearing what, the high-vis yellow jacket. So you wear a high-vis yellow jacket, you can do anything.
It's actually pretty much true, that, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, I travel around London in high-vis and enter all sorts of places. Yeah. No, that maybe that's...
Snatching phones and... Yeah,
well, no, John, I don't. Thank you very much. It's gone too far, so I'll turn his microphone off. If only I had that power. John Pienaar is here between 4 o'clock and seven on Times Radio. Yes, if you wear a high-vis jacket regularly, does it mean that you can go anywhere and get away with anything? 0333 003 2353. Let me just bring in some of your points of view on the royals, because they are still coming. People care about this. Perhaps you might be one of those people who thinks, what's the fuss? But trust me, people do care about it. Cher, who's one of our American listeners, good afternoon to you. She says, what about Andrew and Sarah's daughters? How are they being affected? They didn't ask for any of this. Well, I think that's, of course, absolutely right. And your heart, I have to say, does go out to them. Amanda, I think Josh was right. That was an earlier WhatsApper. The Princess Royal is great. Pity we can't say the same thing for some of the others. That's Amanda. On the other hand, I like this from Simon, but I like it only in the interest of balance. I encountered Princess Anne in the course of my work, and I found her to be cold, rude, ungracious, charmless, and entitled. Right, well, there we are. And John says, granted, not all members of the royal family are capable of behaving in a way that allegedly Andrew has done, but collectively, I was choosing my words there, but collectively, they've got too much of our money. In view of the cost of living crisis, we need to revisit the civil list, says John in Basingstoke. Keep them coming, 0333 003 2353. Now, let's investigate the bizarre story of the fraudster and sex offender, Nicholas Rossi. It's coming to a bit of a head today, this story. Originally from the States, Rossi was arrested in Glasgow back in 2021, where he claimed to be everything from an Irish academic to the victim of a medical conspiracy. Today, he's going to be sentenced in the state of Utah for one of two rape convictions, which could carry a life sentence. Mark Horn is a senior reporter for The Times and The Sunday Times, based in Glasgow. Now, Mark, I know this is a saga going back quite some time, but tell us what you're able to about this man, Rossi.
So he's an absolutely fascinating character. The first time I met him, he was wearing an oxygen mask. He was dressed as Winston Churchill. He had a 1940s suit on. He also had, he was in a wheelchair, and he spoke in a wheezing approximation of an English accent. It was utterly bizarre.
Yes, I mean, I do remember seeing that image, and there was a great deal of attention around this at the time. I remember listening to a very good podcast series on it. What's happened since that first image that most of us became aware of?
So he thought he could fool the world with this bizarre pantomime persona, but of course it cut no ice with the courts. He was identified. He said he was Arthur Knight. The courts identified him as Nicholas Rossi. He was extradited to the US last year, and he's twice been found guilty of rape since then.
But he did try to avoid conviction. In fact, he tried to avoid extradition. He involved all sorts of other people, and some people were presumably complicit or apparently believing him. What about them?
Well, the most fascinating part of this whole saga is Rossi's wife, Miranda, who's from Bristol. Now, she stood by her husband the whole time. She spoke up for him in court and insisted that what he said was true, that he was an innocent Irish-born academic and that he'd never been to the US. Now, of course, that proved not to be true in the long run. And people are confused as to what her motivation is. Some people are saying that she is an accomplice, that she is part of this. And other people suggest that Miranda is also a victim of coercive control, domestic abuse. Because that seems to be his pattern of behaviour.
Yes, he has been convicted of two serious offences, two rape convictions. What is likely to happen to him?
So the prosecutors in Utah are suggesting that he should get life imprisonment without any possibility of parole. So it's looking a very real possibility.
Thank you very much indeed. I appreciate your time this afternoon. That's quite the tale. Mark Horn, senior reporter for The Times and The Sunday Times, based in Glasgow. Now, this is a hugely important story and something you'll be aware of if you are a reader of The Sunday Times. Agnes Wanjiru was just 21 when she was killed near a British Army base in Kenya. It has taken 13 years of campaigning by her family and exhaustive coverage of the story in The Sunday Times for her alleged killer, a British soldier, to begin to face extradition. The UK has now pledged to support the investigation into the death of Agnes, with the Defence Secretary, John Healey, praising her family's campaigning. I've been talking to Agnes's niece, Esther Njoki. She came to Britain last week for a meeting at the Ministry of Defence. Esther is now 21 herself, the same age as her aunt Agnes when she was killed.
21, it's a significant number to me. I should be enjoying my life somewhere here in London, but again, I'm here for wrong reasons, which it's because of the government failing to do the right thing. Agnes was 21. I was 8 years old while she passed away. And the circumstances that followed after her murder is the one that always pains us a lot. At 21, she was very young. I can imagine I have so many things I want to achieve, I'm yet to achieve. So I think it was a great loss. I can't imagine right now not being alive because someone has to end my life. So it's hard.
What you want to achieve, and as you say, you shouldn't be having to do this at your age, is to get justice for your aunt. What can you remember about what happened when she was killed?
First, I don't only want to achieve justice for Agnes, but to change how things are being done by the British soldiers. There is a way we can do that by making sure that the laws that are put in place are being followed and there is punishment if someone is gotten in the wrong. So Agnes, I mean, we can bring back Agnes, but again, through Agnes' case, we can make a difference so that no one else has to go what Agnes went through or what my family has went through, waiting for 13 years for a step to be taken. It's hard, but we keep on pushing.
How is her sister, your mother, Rose? How is she?
She's not good because it was Agnes' mum died while she was young. So my mum is the firstborn, so she was the one taking care of her. Again, Agnes used to help my mum by taking care of us. So again, and then she was the last born, so she left a small child. So I think she's not okay, I mean, mentally. This is something that has made her, I mean, even have health problems, thinking of what her sister went through, and also being left with that child who you don't know what to tell her, what happened to your mom, why has action not been taken. I mean, it's something big to her, and that's why I think I stood up to speak up and to make sure that our Agnes Long denied right, like, we have been served justice. Yeah.
So there is also a young girl involved, Stacey, Agnes's daughter. How is she?
She's also not okay. You know, this matter, it has really affected so many people. And so her daughter came to learn of it while she was grown. But again, this matter is really affecting her, especially now that she's understanding what injustice means. And I think what has been keeping me moving is when I see her break down, when she sees her mom's stories, or when someone comes, or maybe when we are meeting someone, like, I know it has always been hard, but again, there is a way we can do this, and that's why I'm here, to make a change. I know she can't speak up, and that's why I always speak up for her, and to ensure that justice has been served, and no child will ever have to go through what Stacey's going through.
So during this trip to London, you have had a meeting with the Defence Secretary, Mr. Healey. What was that like?
This is the second meeting with the Secretary of State for Defence, and I would really like to commend him for the work that he's doing, because this is the first time that we're seeing this. Even, I think, I've never seen any other minister meeting victims. I mean, when it comes to the British atrocities, he's the first minister. And since he came into the position, you have seen significant things happening, like the investigation are through, which were dragging their feet. Also, at least another step has been taken of issuance of a warrant of arrest. And we are hoping that going forward that he will continue supporting us by making sure that this matter will come to completion and our souls will rest.
So we do know that the man who is alleged to have done this to your aunt has been named. There are people who believe they know who it is. And indeed, there is one soldier who did say, who is saying, that he went to the authorities at the time of the murder and told them what had happened. Why wasn't anything done?
I think the reason why no action was taken, I think it's the culture of cover-up and impunity by the soldier, by the army. And that's why, even one of the things that made me come here is to change the internal systems of the army, because I believe we can change this by us being as examples, by ensuring that those who helped the alleged murderer, has been, action has been taken against them. I know Mr. Healy promised that all those MODs who are there and failed to act will take action against them. And I think it's the best thing because they'll know, those who are in position now and those who will ever come in future to be in position, they'll know there's something that happened many years ago and these are the repercussions is if I don't take any action when the soldiers have committed the crime. And that's why I'm here, because I think that's where the problem is, the internal systems of the army, because if they could have done something, we could not have waited for 13 years for something to happen.
Esther, this must be very difficult for you to listen to. You just want this over, don't you? You want this to be sorted out as soon as possible.
Yeah, for sure I want it to be solved as soon as possible, because this is someone who knew what he had done. It was reported, it was a running joke, so I don't know why the authorities want us even to follow the law. This is someone who should be jailed. I mean, he has been risking lives out here in London, here in UK. Because someone who even mocks a dead person and mocks the child that has been left behind, is that even someone who is normal?
Yeah. So, Esther, if you had the chance to speak to this man today, what would you say to him?
I mean, I would want him to be extradited and be taken to where he committed the crime and to pay for his sins, because he didn't only cause our lives, also, the friend... He's also, he has caused so many people, the trauma, the lives of people have changed, Sojawai. He didn't only cause the Agnes family, but even other families were affected because of him. And just because the systems didn't do anything, the alleged man should just go to hell. He deserved the hell, because... I don't think he's normal. I don't think even he values human life. Because if he did, he could not even have joked. At least he could have murdered, but not go ahead and joke. But again, going as far as even joking, that one was so wrong. Especially when they were saying that they could see a child crying at the grave. Now Stacey's grown. She understands. What do you think she feels if it was your daughter? Now. He's also a parent. Imagine now it's his kids who are feeling what Stacey always go through every time, trying to understand. She never got to see her mom. She never got to know who her mom is. You can imagine she'll have to live with that pain all her life just because someone did what he did. And again, even he was a medic, so he knew even Agnes was either dead or not. So I don't know what excuse that he can come up with for us to understand.
Esther, I'm so sorry this has happened to you and to your family. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you.
She's such an impressive young woman, Esther Njoki, who is seeking justice for her aunt, Agnes Wanjiru, who was killed at the age of 21, very close to a British army base in Kenya. Let's hope there's really substantial progress in that case very soon. Next on Times Radio, should you really be picking your fruit and veg from the forest floor? Is it sensible? It's Times Radio. We're with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Global events.
How difficult is it for culture in Ukraine to thrive when the country's under assault?
Breaking news.
A crisis that has spiralled into the Middle East as competition for resources intensifies.
Reactive analysis.
We'll consider what's at stake for both leaders and our national politics.
From the world's best journalists.
Two people with different perspectives tell us what they think about today's events.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Growing a business takes a powerful team. People who think big, raise the bar and smash expectations. People who are feeling at their best, not worried and waiting for healthcare. If you're ready to take your business to the next level, you need a team that's ready to deliver. Bupa helps your people to get health worries seen and sorted with fast access to expert advice, including GPs and physios. Your team will have fast help for muscle, bone and joint problems, plus mental health services and cancer cover as standard, so they're ready for whatever life throws at them, at home and at work. Take your business further by building a happier, healthier and more motivated team. And as prevention is better than cure, your team will have access to our digital wellbeing services, including 1,500 gym classes, mindfulness programmes and expert content. That's better for your team and better for your business. Get ready to power your growth with small business health insurance that powers your people. Let's get growing. Search Bupa Small Business.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silver Sea brings you closer to the rare, the remote and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate. To finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Still getting quite a lot of messages from you on the subject of Andrew. And Becky says, I think it is important not to get too caught up in the personalities in the royal family. Your earlier guest, Tessa Dunlop, was absolutely right. The crucial thing now is to increase transparency around the family so the elected government can have some levers to hold them to account, particularly in their business dealings. And Gilly has an interesting insight. She says, as a journalist, I trailed around after many royals over the years. The hack pack always kept at a distance lest we pollute the royal air. The one who was friendliest to the press and actually acknowledged our existence was, who do you think? Gilly's been there and she says that person was, perhaps unexpectedly, Princess Margaret. Right, Britain's growing army of middle-class foragers searching woodlands for wild berries, mushrooms and other seasonal produce do seem to be causing increasing damage to local habitats and sometimes to themselves. The Berkshire, Buckinghamshire and Oxfordshire Wildlife Trust has issued a warning on social media, reminding people that foraging is banned on its reserves because it can do real harm to fragile ecosystems. And a recent study has also suggested that wild plants can pose health risks. Let's talk to Andy Coulson, who's principal ecologist at the Berkshire, Buckinghamshire and Oxfordshire Wildlife Trust. So despite the warnings, damage is still being done and people are still foraging, Andy. What are they after?
Well, various things at this time of year. It's mostly fungi that people are after, although there are still things like sloes in the hedgerows. So that's quite a popular one.
Really, that's to make gin, is it?
Yeah, to flavour gins.
Yeah. I mean, it's very nice, but you presumably you'd be entirely safe to do that, would you?
To which one? To pick sloes?
Yes, yeah.
Yes, that's a safe thing to do.
Right. What do they look like?
Sloes?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're kind of sort of very deep purple marble-sized things that grow on blackthorn shrubs.
Right, so you're unlikely to mistake them for anything else, quite frankly.
Yeah, I can't think of anything else that looks immediately like a slow. No.
Okay, so what? I think we're all right. We've established you'll be okay with a slow, and then you can make some beautiful winter-enhancing gin. But what about the damage being done to the habitats by foragers? What is actually happening?
Well, the one that we were sort of really trying to highlight in our message was fungi foraging, and that's particularly an issue at this time of year. And so I'd just like to say the problem with fungi foraging as opposed to something like picking sloes or blackberries is that when people are taking a fruiting body of a fungi species, they're taking the whole thing, whereas when you're picking a sloe or a blackberry, you're picking one individual fruit. So the equivalent would be with picking a fungi fruiting body would be like taking an entire bush or bramble bush or blackthorn tree. So we're not really sort of comparing like for like. So that's particularly why we had an issue with fungi. And the problem with taking the fruiting bodies of fungi is we're a bit concerned that it's affecting some of these species' ability to reproduce, because in case your listeners don't know, the fungi is the body that produces the spores, and then the spores go and get distributed across the land, and where they land, then new nets of fungi start to develop under the ground.
Right, so if humans come along and remove them for eating purposes, well, that's clearly it's not productive, it's not helpful to you at all, is it?
No, it's taking away the whole fruiting body. And what we were particularly finding in some cases with the fungi foraging is that people don't just come along and take one fruiting body, one toadstool. They're taking all that they find, which is obviously sort of quite damaging locally to a population. And then even worse sometimes, and we have seen this, is that people collect everything, then they go away and find out which is edible and which isn't, but they've harvested everything there in the meantime. And that's a bit like somebody trawling in the ocean and collecting one species out of the catch and then, you know, just discarding the rest, except when sometimes when you discard a trawl, there are still live ones. If you discard picked fungi, they're already dead.
It's more than a hobby for some people, isn't it? It's a sort of point of principle that they feel that it's somehow more authentic to go and forage. But are you actually saying, could you just go to the supermarket, please?
Yeah, well, so you are able to forage on private property if you get permission of the landowner. That's perfectly acceptable. So if you can find a sympathetic landowner who has woodlands or sort of ancient grasslands where fungi are plentiful, and you can approach them and they say yes, it's fine, then that's fine. We just didn't want it to happen on our nature reserves, partly because of the sort of indiscriminate damage and the large scale that it was happening at, and partly because our nature reserves are home to some quite rare species. So again, unwittingly, people might target some of the rare species which we wanted to avoid. And so given that things were sort of going a bit wrong, we took the decision just to say no on our property. But you can still forage fungi if you find someone who is prepared to let you do it.
Yep, okay, we've got the message. Thank you very much. Andy Coulson making it clear he doesn't want foragers. Foragers. Well, right, here we go.
Online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
How dare that jingle interrupt me? It's absolutely incredible, isn't it? Yes, Andy Coulson there, speaking on behalf of everybody involved at that Wildlife Trust in Berkshire, Buckinghamshire and Oxfordshire. Don't go foraging for your fungi on that bit of land. Thank you very much. It's 3 o'clock. This is Jane Garvey on Times Radio. In the next hour, President Trump's Middle East envoy is in Israel to try and solidify that very fragile ceasefire deal. And pet insurance, honestly, is it worth it? Adam Shaw, our money man, is back with us before 4 o'clock. Let's get the news. Here's Andy Hayes.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Blind people have been able to read again after having a tiny microchip inserted in the back of their eyeball. More from Times Radio's Will Hobbs.
Patients who were previously living in darkness took part in a trial with a team at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London and can now recognise faces, do crosswords and read books. They had an operation to insert an ultra-thin implant into their eyeball that's connected to high-tech glasses containing a video camera enabling signals to be transmitted to the brain. 70-year-old Sheila Irvin was one of those taking part. She was an avid bookworm before going blind and has now learnt to read again.
Hamas says the body of another Israeli hostage will be released at 6 p.m. UK time and says it was exhumed yesterday in Gaza. The Hamas-run health ministry says the bodies of 57 Palestinians have been taken to hospitals inside the enclave in the last 24 hours. It claims 45 were killed in direct targeting by Israel. Two Israeli soldiers were killed in fighting yesterday. Amazon says most services affected by problems with its cloud computing software are working normally again. Concerns were reported with several apps and websites, including Zoom, some banks and HMRC. Global security advisor Jake Moores told Times Radio this points towards the fragility of the domain name system.
That's when you type in your web URL, so the Times website, for example, and then it has to turn into numbers so the internet understands it. And that's why it goes into an IP address. And when those things fall over, you get big problems. Unfortunately, when it happens on AWS, so Amazon's web servers, you have even bigger problems because they make up around 30% of the internet.
Pizza Hut is to close 68 restaurants after the company running its UK venues fell into administration. It's not clear how many workers are likely to be affected. Prince Andrew's team has been accused of trying to hire internet trolls to hassle Virginia Giuffre. The allegations have appeared in her posthumous memoir, which is out tomorrow. The royals always denied her claim that he had sex with her three times. There's a famous picture depicting Virginia Giuffre with Prince Andrew and Ghislaine Maxwell. Royal historian Tessa Dunlop says it's haunting.
She, in that picture, has taken her own life. The individual taking the picture, Jeffrey Epstein, has taken his own life. Ghislaine Maxwell is in prison, the only man walking free, unencumbered, voluntarily giving up his Duke title at the weekend to save his brother's blushes, is Prince Andrew. And this entire saga speaks to a made in Great Britain problem, which is the untouchability of the royal family.
And the son of former England footballer Stuart Pearce has been killed in a tractor crash. 21-year-old Harley Pearce is believed to have lost control of the vehicle in Gloucestershire on Thursday. His sister Chelsea says he was a golden boy with an infectious smile. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online, and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Good afternoon. It's Jane, actually, just Jane this afternoon. I'm here until 4 o'clock. Fee's not too well, but very much hoping to be back with us tomorrow afternoon. John Pienaar, of course, will be coming your way here on Times Radio from 4. You are continuing to message us about Andrew. Michael says the whole system of having a royal family isn't healthy for the individuals born into it or the country as a whole. Bar a quirk of fate, stroke birth, Andrew could have been king with no accountability or ability for us to remove him. Just imagine that, says Michael. Well, yes, we can just about imagine it. Richard says the focus on Andrew in relation to his inquiry about the background of Virginia appears misplaced. Why are people not asking if the police officer actually went ahead with the inquiry? While Andrew may not have been aware of the legality or lack of it of his alleged actions, the copper should simply have ignored the request. Alternatively, given potential pressure from His Highness, a simple answer would be nothing found. Come on, Times, let's open the discussion to these wider questions, says Richard, who adds that he is not a royalist. Thank you very much. We do need to keep emphasising that Andrew denies all the allegations. Tomorrow on this programme, you will hear from a woman called Amy Wallace. She is the person who helped Virginia Giuffre write her memoir, Nobody's Child, which is officially published tomorrow. I did get a preview copy of that book and I have read it, and it genuinely is harrowing. It's an incredibly sad story of a woman's life, which simply, well, it didn't start well, to be perfectly honest, and it ended with her taking her own life after some really, really poor physical and mental health over the last couple of years. And, of course, she really had been through hell. I don't think that's an exaggeration, at the hands not just of Jeffrey Epstein, but of very many other men. And actually, there are lots of questions about those other men. I suppose you could say that Britain is at least discussing the alleged activities of Prince Andrew. Not every nation on earth has yet come to terms with the behaviour of some of its citizens, alleged behaviour of some of its citizens in respect of Jeffrey Epstein. So that's tomorrow afternoon then. That's Amy Wallace on the programme talking about her work with Virginia Giuffre after 3:30. Now, Donald Trump's Middle East envoy Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner are now in Israel amidst increasing pressure on that US-brokered ceasefire deal. Israel claimed IDF troops were killed by Hamas militants yesterday, leading it to temporarily resume airstrikes across Gaza. A report from the US emerged overnight suggesting that the deaths were accidental and actually caused by a bulldozer running over unexploded ordnance. While over the last week there have been multiple reports of Hamas torturing and killing Palestinians in Gaza. It's a very confused picture. It doesn't sound very much like what we might consider a ceasefire, but it's certainly a very fragile ceasefire if it exists at all. Let's bring in Oliver McTernan, conflict resolution expert and co-founder and director of Forward Thinking. Oliver, how do you think things are going, if I can ask a question as obvious as that?
Well, I think, as you said, it is extremely fragile. And of course, in a situation like this, it's a spoilers opportunity. I think on both sides, there'll be groups in Gaza that would like to spoil this. And certainly, I think in Israel, there will be people who feel that this truce or ceasefire at the moment is not in their advantage. So I think we're in a very precarious situation at present.
Can you explain who these people are, the people who want to keep the conflict going? Who are they and why do they want to keep it going?
Well, I think what we've got to recognise that in the last 2 years, there are gangs or clans that have made, I'm told, a lot of money out of the conflict. They were the transit, you might say, for goods coming in from Israel, which they could sell at high prices in the markets. Now, one of these gangs was the Dagmouche family. And I recall going to Gaza in the years 2004 to 2006. And you always had to have armed gangs for the fear that the Dagmouches would kidnap you. You may recall that the BBC reporter, Alan Johnson, was kidnapped for a time there and held by the Dagmouches, who were then masquerading under what they call themselves the Army of God. Now, they emerged again as a strong presence, especially in the last 6 months or so in Gaza.
You really do have to feel incredible sympathy for the ordinary individual trying to eke out some kind of existence with this in the background of their daily life. How depressed must they be feeling right now, Oliver?
I think they're at their end. The number of people that I know in Gaza who in the last month in particular said, we've reached the end. They were people I would never think would want to move from Gaza. Gaza's their home. They've been through five previous wars. They had great resilience and they were there to rebuild and to restore, be it education, health, in all of these areas. But in the last month or so, prior to the ceasefire, they were saying, we've just reached the end. Psychologically, we can't continue, because they were living with the reality that this may be the last 5 minutes of their life.
Do you honestly believe that this ceasefire, in its current form, such as it is the beginning of a proper peace process?
No. And the reason for that is that I think it's an opportunity, let me say, but I don't think the way it is being planned out, the 20-point plan, is the basis for any process that will lead to a sustainable or durable peace. And I say that first and foremost because if you look at the 20 points, There's no reference to international law. It's as if international law and the rule-based order that grew out of the Second World War is no longer relevant. Now, I find that very dangerous, because at the end of the day, we will only have peace if the Palestinian right to self-determination and agency, in other words, to their own viable state in what is now internationally recognized as the occupied territories. Unless that happens, any effort will be, in my opinion, like papering over a crack. And you know well, if you go into a house where there are foundational problems and cracks in the walls, paper is not going to solve it. And I think this 20-point plan risks being that.
We know that Egypt is to host talks with Hamas chief negotiator today, we're told. Without this, without their control of Gaza, what does this organisation have? I suppose I'm just simply trying to work out why they would want to make peace with Israel. What is in it for them?
Well, if you go back even the last 20 years, 2005, they engaged in municipal elections right over the occupied territories. Now, that was a sign that we're beginning to accept the political realities. Then they stood for a national election. And when they won the national election in 2006, the first thing they tried to do was form a united government, that they bring Fatah and the independent parties into government. What happened? Condoleezza Rice, Elliot Abrahams, made sure that that was blocked. Conditions were put that would almost be there as an obstacle to them furthering along the political line.
Right. Explain why you believe that that was the case, that American intervention stopped that happening. Why would they do that?
Well, I recall the European Union had a meeting, and the European foreign ministers were together. And I'm told by someone who was at that meeting that Condoleezza Rice came and persuaded them to proscribe the Hamas political section. In other words, to stop any further negotiation as how they could be incorporated into the political system. Now, I'm told also that once they made that decision, they realized it was a mistake and they had no mechanism to reverse it, because to reverse it at that time, they needed the whole 27 countries to agree. And of course, countries like Hungary and the Czech Republic were very much following the American line. So there was no chance of reversal. Then they came in, worked with various former US ambassadors and European ambassadors, and came up with a political policy in 2007, in which they actually accepted a two-state solution on 67 borders. That again was just pushed aside, rejected. So every effort, I think, that they tried to enter into the political process was rejected. And of course, that then, I fear, strengthened the militants, and I fear led to what we witnessed, the horrendous acts that we witnessed on the 7th of October.
Can I just bring this point to you, made by a listener called Debs, who says, I doubt there is a solution to the situation between Israel and the Palestinian people. It's gone on too long. It's too deeply ingrained, too much suffering on both sides that underlies all this horrible mess. Each generation has perpetuated distrust and hatred. I mean, Debs is probably speaking for many people who don't really see that this can be resolved. But do you have, are there any grounds for optimism, Oliver?
To do my job, you have to be an optimist. And I would just say to Deb, this is a human problem, and human problems can be solved. I look at the Irish problem. 800 years of conflict was solved when we stopped trying to solve it top down and impose solutions. They didn't work. It was when someone got the insight saying the only way to solve this is create an inclusive process. Everyone who is concerned about the situation needs to be at the table. And what comes out of it needs to be based on sufficient consensus to move forward. That is the utter basis of the Good Friday Agreement. I honestly think a similar process is possible in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but to get it, I think the international community needs to have both the political and moral courage to push it. It's essentially a grievance-based conflict. And I think once Israel realizes that its security is not in dominating Palestinians or having total dominance over their life, but in actual giving them the space to be, in other words, peace through justice.
Yeah, but Oliver, people haven't forgotten the horrific events of October the 7th, truly diabolical, abhorrent violence inflicted on Israeli people and for example, the kibbutz and the music festival. You can understand why Israel feels incredibly vulnerable.
100%. And I've been in Israel many times since that event. And I can say that at all levels, I find people extremely traumatized, and more so in the Knesset, that people are really traumatized. There's the inherited collective and now individual trauma that people are trying to deal with. We can understand that. But the other side of that coin, you know, this didn't start on October the 7th. And I know some people don't like to be reminded of that. But we're dealing with a 77-year cycle of violence. I've witnessed five wars in Gaza. I've seen the after effect on the Gazan people, especially in 2014, where whole areas were obliterated and you could smell the dead bodies lying under the rubble. People had to deal with that. They're traumatized. They have to deal with that trauma. But I'd say at the end of the day, it's not an obstacle to finding a durable solution. It is the only way forward. The two peoples finding enough, sufficient trust and vision to be able to live by side and find in each other their security. I think that's not a dream. It's a real possibility.
Thank you. Some optimism there from Oliver McTurnan. It's worth saying that J.D. Vance, the American vice president, is expected in Israel tomorrow. Good afternoon to you. You are listening to Times Radio. There's been another spat between Donald Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky. We'll talk about that in a moment. We're heading towards 19 minutes past three. It's Jane Garvey on Times Radio with Wix, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Tomorrow, The Times and the Sunday Times Tech Summit 2025 gets underway, and Rosie Wright will bring you updates throughout the day live from the Barbican as a stellar lineup of industry leaders convene to discuss Britain's quest to become a tech superpower. The Times and the Sunday Times Tech Summit 2025. Throughout the day tomorrow, only on Times Radio.
They're bubbly, they're fuzzy, and they're ruddy delicious.
At Oddbox, we rescue farm fresh fruit and veg that's too odd for supermarkets. Then we deliver direct to your door, so every box and every crunch makes a difference to growers and the planet. Use the code RADIO to get 50% off your first box at oddbox.co.uk and help fight food waste, one curvy cucumber at a time. Offer excludes delivery fees, conditions apply.
My dad is more than just a dad. My dad provides life-changing support to those affected by disaster and conflict, helping people in crisis, whoever and wherever they are. Through the gift that he left in his will to the British Red Cross, my dad still makes a difference to the world, even though he's no longer with us. You can make a difference too. Please go online and search Red Cross Wills and consider leaving a gift in your will to the British Red Cross.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier, all built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
Listen at 6:30 every weekday morning for your indispensable briefing on the latest politics, business and sports news of the day.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms, helping create rooms to feel proud of. From design consultants who'll measure your space and bring your vision to life on a 3D plan through to a professional installation service. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
President Zelensky is calling on Europe to stand firm behind Ukraine after a heated meeting with Donald Trump, which apparently turned into a shouting match. The US president is said to have urged President Zelensky to be prepared to give up land to Russia, a demand the Ukrainian leader rejected. Lara Spirit is Washington correspondent for The Times. Lara, when was this meeting and what exactly was the atmosphere?
Yes, so this meeting, you'll remember, happened at the end of last week. It was a closed meeting. It was different from some of those that we'd seen recently. We did see, of course, Trump sat across from Zelensky in the White House. We saw reporters asking questions, and we saw a more positive atmosphere between the pair than we'd seen, most notably in the bust up that they had earlier on this year, when both Trump and J.D. Vance, the vice president, lambasted Zelensky for what they perceived to be ingratitude on the part of the Ukrainian leader towards US and support from others towards Ukraine for the war and following Russia's invasion. This time round, we read, according to various reports, that there was an extremely testy private meeting between President Zelensky and President Trump last week, which followed on from a call that President Trump had had with Putin, in which Putin had clearly, or it seems, managed to impress upon Trump some of his key talking points. We read in reports that Trump said that Zelensky needed to be aware that Putin didn't even see this as a war. He saw this as an operation, a special operation, and that he was said to have told Zelensky that Putin could destroy him if he wanted to, clearly making an impression upon Zelensky that has meant that he is this week rallying support from European leaders, from that so-called coalition of the willing, to try and make sure that Ukraine stands firm at this critical moment in the war.
I think listeners will be musing to themselves that we've been here before, haven't we, with Donald Trump spouting the Kremlin lines.
Well, it's very interesting because, of course, we had the Alaska summit between Putin and Trump. And up until that point, there had been a question about just how strong the support from the US might be towards Ukrainians and what Trump's position on a possible resolution might look like. We had, of course, during that summit, you know, Putin not making any massively significant concessions and also talking at length about Ukrainian medieval history, for example, as clearly a summit which did not yield immediate results and which led to the US, in some sense, exploring further options for supporting Ukraine, including potentially Tomahawk missiles, which we had heard Trump sound amenable to and then a bit later on sound much less amenable to, saying last week that they're a big deal. We don't want to be giving away things. We need to protect our country. Also warning of the risks of potential escalation. And Zelensky, in that sense, appearing to have left the White House empty handed. Of course, now we've seen these further reports that Trump is clearly frustrated. There are quotes in various reports suggesting that he bought up the Nobel Peace Prize, which has until this point remained elusive to the president. We know that he would like that award. And since, of course, securing that tentative ceasefire, which is now, of course, being very much tested between Hamas and Israel, that some in the White House, including Trump, are clearly turning their attention to Ukraine to see if they can get a resolution to this. But Zelensky not at all willing to, it seems, cede any of the Donbass region that Russia has failed to secure. Territorial concessions appear to be something that Trump is now really pushing for, and which Zelensky, according to an address last night and reports today, is very much firmly set against. So in that sense, we don't seem to be in any case saying that the Trump position and the Zelensky position are one. Whether or not this week we've got a summit of European leaders on Thursday, for example, to see if they can rally some support for Ukraine at this moment where US support looks a bit more wobbly or uncertain than it did in recent days, but certainly nervous times for the Ukrainians and for those in the European coalition of the willing who want to see this end with Zelensky in a triumphant position.
And briefly, if you can, just remind me what the timing is on this, the meeting that was supposed to be happening in Budapest. This is the Putin-Trump meeting. Is that still on?
Well, we don't know the exact timings of that yet so far, so we'll be looking this week to know whether or not we'll get any further details on when that potential meeting in Budapest may happen.
Right. Thank you very much, Lara. That's Lara Spirit, who is the Washington correspondent for The Times. Now, shall we go to Coventry? Is that what we're doing next? Yes, yes, we're going to Coventry. And in particular, we're going to celebrate the success, the recent success of Coventry City Football Club. Here's their song. Well, it was something I wasn't really aware of until I was made aware on the socials over the weekend of the Coventry City fans singing a song called We Live and Die in These Towns by a local band called The Enemy. And it's played, I think, as Coventry City get on the pitch ahead of their games. We should say this weekend Coventry have reclaimed their spot at the top of the Championship following a 2-0 victory over Blackburn Rovers. They are managed by former England and Chelsea player Frank Lampard. Miles Cadden is the presenter of Sky Blue Fans TV. Hi, Miles.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having us on.
Well, I'm really interested in this story and particularly in the importance of that song. Can you just tell us when it first started being played in the stadium?
Yeah, so it all come around about 3 years ago. The anniversary actually is the 4th of November when we get to play Sheffield United. And the band are going to be coming onto the pitch before the game to play the song live. And it was all down to Stuart Court, who does the music at the ground before the games, and John Dazow, who's a radio presenter on different radio stations.
Yeah.
And they both come up with the idea, shall we try it and see if the fans will sing along, because they're a local band. And they were the first Coventry band to get a number one album as well, which was great. So they thought they're going to play it and see how it goes. And it just took off, and all the fans now, they sing it before the game, just as they've come out onto the pitch and they're getting ready to kick off.
Yeah.
We all stand around, we all sing the song. But it made it massive on social media at Wembley in the playoffs, when we made the playoffs a couple of seasons ago.
Right.
And It just erupted, and it's just gone on from there. And it makes an amazing atmosphere, yeah, well, within the ground.
It really does. I have to say, I find it really stirring. This is moving. I you know, some football songs obviously get you. I mean, obviously, I'm a Liverpool fan, and You'll Never Walk Alone is unbeatable. But this is incredible. There's something very poignant about it. Do you agree?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely is. I mean, it's all about, you know, the local areas of Coventry, and it touches the hearts of everybody. I think last season we had an away shirt which we didn't win in all season. It was white, but it had a pattern on it of, yeah, all the areas around Coventry and Warwickshire, and that's how the shirt was designed, and it was a cracking design. Mm. We just never won a game in it.
Well, never mind that. That'll be a collector's item now, I guess.
Yeah, probably, yeah. The shirt we never won a game in.
Yeah, well, but things are going so much better. And Coventry City are one of those teams. I mean, I remember when they won the FA Cup. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. They should be in the Premier League, shouldn't they?
Well, we dream of it again, you know. I mean, we got relegated in 2001, and sometimes I blame it on getting married to my wife, because...
Oh, don't blame... Well, Miles, that's outrageous.
That's the year we went down, so the year I got married. So sometimes I do blame it on the wife, but not all the time, honest. I don't. I do let her get away with it. But yeah, it's been a long time coming, and you know, we were on the verge of probably dropping out of the Football League altogether. You know, we tumbled right down to League Two. We had one shot of getting out of League Two, which we did. We managed to do it in the first season through the playoffs, and then we consolidated 1 year in League One. Then we went up and won the league in League One, thanks to COVID.
Yeah.
But I think it was about 8 games to go, but we'd lost 3 games all season. I couldn't see us losing then. Mm-hmm. And then we're back in the Championship, and it's amazing, really, the story of us in the Championship, because we struggled the first season, but we've been building a team. We've been building a team year in, year out. And, you know, it all started with Mark Robbins, Adi Vardash, Dennis Lawrence, building the foundations. Dave Boddy was the chief executive at the time. Fantastic chap. And, you know, this has all come about from the foundations, from league getting relegated from League One, then starting again in League Two and building it up till now. And Frank, Joe Edwards, John Dempster. So Frank's head coach, assistant head coach is Joe Edwards, and then John Dempster's the first team coach. And those guys have come in. We've got the same, virtually the same team. We've got a few new faces that have come in. Matty Grimes has been revelation since he signed last January. And but Frank and the team have come in and they've put a fresh ideas, younger ideas in the team. And we've been saying on our podcast, on our channel, where every Sunday and Thursday we do live shows, and we have fan interaction, and everyone's saying that we've now got a winning mentality.
All right, well, don't get ahead of yourselves, Miles.
I'm not.
Quickly, what's the next game?
So we've got Portsmouth tomorrow night, and we're travelling down. We're stopping the night. It's Ken, who's on our show. It's his birthday. So we're going down tomorrow, Portsmouth. Right. But they beat us 4-1 last season. Mm. So it's revenge time tomorrow.
That's Fratton Park, isn't it? Am I right?
It is, yeah.
Yes, Fratton Park. Yes, I'm still in therapy after using the ladies once at Fratton Park. But anyway, there you go. I'm sure they've been upgraded. It was some time ago. Lovely to talk to you, Miles. Very best to Coventry City. And I'm going to be following them the rest of the season. I really hope they do get promoted. It really is poignant, that. Just look it up if you haven't seen it. The fans at Coventry City singing "We Live and Die in These Towns" by local Coventry band The Enemy. That was Miles McCadden. Thank you very much to him. Now, coming next, we've got the best books of the week with our resident erudite bibliophile, Robbie Millen. And we're asking Adam Shaw, is pet insurance really worth it? It's all here on Times Radio in the next half an hour. After the headlines, Andy Hayes.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Thank you, Jane. Good afternoon. Blind people have been able to read again after having a tiny microchip inserted in the back of their eyeball. Patients who were previously living in darkness took part in a trial with a team at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London. They can now recognise faces, do crosswords and read books. Hamas says the body of another Israeli hostage will be released at 6 p.m. UK time and says it was exhumed yesterday in Gaza. The Hamas-run health ministry says the bodies of 57 Palestinians have been taken to hospitals inside the enclave in the last 24 hours. Two Israeli soldiers were killed in fighting yesterday. Amazon says most services affected by problems with its cloud computing software are working normally again. Concerns were reported with several apps and websites, including Zoom, some banks and HMRC. Global security advisor Jake Moore has told Times Radio it doesn't appear to be a cyber attack.
Obviously, can never be completely ruled out, although if it were a cyber attack, I would suggest that it would have pointed those websites to another site, say, for example, a criminal website, to make people aware of it. In this case, we're just seeing them not work. So it's unlikely, but of course, it has to be part of the investigation afterwards.
And the 21-year-old son of former England footballer Stuart Pearce has been killed in a tractor crash. Gloucestershire Police says Harley Pearce died at the scene in Whitcombe last Thursday. He ran his own company and worked on a variety of farms across the Wiltshire-Gloucestershire border. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for a Times News briefing on the Times Radio app.
This is Times Radio.
My dad was a fantastic builder. Plumbing, electrics, carpentry, there was nothing he couldn't do. But he's 83 now and he can't do any of that stuff anymore. That's hard when you've always been so capable. Unfortunately, Mum died a couple of years ago now, so he does feel quite isolated. Huh. At least he did until Kerry arrived. She's been amazing. She's Dad's care professional from Home Instead. They provide the best quality care in your own home. Dad'll never want to leave that cottage. Well, he restored it practically from scratch, all on his own. We all pop over to see him whenever we can, but we've all got busy lives. So it's real peace of mind that Kerry can be there when we're not. She helps him with all the things he can't do for himself anymore. But we've told her the only thing she's allowed to do relating to building is make Dad's favourite builder's brew.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. 8 new kitchen styles now available, with prices starting from under £3,000. Whether you choose dusky pink, hazy blue, or one of the other new styles, you'll be delighted with your kitchen transformation. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
Right, it's Monday afternoon. I think you're allowed a digestive, a nice cup of tea, or whatever your favourite brew is. Let's enter our literary salon this week in the company of The Times and Sunday Times literary editor Robbie Millen.
Now, you are here to talk sensibly about, books. What do you have for us this week?
No, I am in a very sensible mood because I've been reading lots of Muriel Spark. Because here I'm going to be sort of all puffed up with self-importance for a moment.
I'm letting you do that.
And it is, I'm chairing the Bailey Gifford Prize for Nonfiction, which is the kind of like the Booker Prize, but for nonfiction.
That's just a little a hint to everybody that you really are a significant individual.
Look at me.
No, but you are.
Well, I do all right.
Yes.
But one of the six books on our shortlist is Electric Spark by Frances Wilson, which is a biography of Muriel Spark, great novelist, Dame Muriel Spark, she was by the end. But it kind of focuses on her early years. But so I've been... At the weekend, I was reading A Far Cry from Kensington, one of Muriel Spark's last novels, but essentially based on her life in the early mid-50s when she was in publishing.
Yeah.
And there's a character called Mrs. Hawkins, which essentially, I think, is a Muriel Spark stand-in. Mm-hmm. And like all Muriel Spark novels, they're very strange. Strange and funny. And Frances Wilson's biography is kind of a real reminder. I mean, the best thing about a biography of an author is it sends you scuttling back to the original text.
Yes.
To which, thank you, Frances Wilson, very good. And you just realise how strange the world Muriel Spark has created. It's full of blackmail. The men in it's usually pretty horrendous. Literary men are ghastly, I think, is the general moral of Muriel Spark's life.
Is that all?
All literary men.
all men.
Well, yes. I suppose, yes. Literary men in particular. Because in the late 40s, early 50s, she was running the Poetry Society and all these kind of sort of fat-faced poets that we've forgotten were all trying to hit on her because she was a very sparky, voluptuous person.
Right.
And she had a rough old time with them, beating them off with a ruler.
Yeah, I mean, I'm tempted to say, have things changed? I don't really know. But A Far Cry from Kensington is a book, I've heard the title.
Yes.
I mean, so is it, what is it, is it a romance of some sort, or is it just an acerbic,
I would say it's a comic novel, but very offbeat, and it's about one woman's sort of journey through literary London. And there's all sorts of things where quite dark things happen, but there's sort of... Muriel Spark during the war worked at Bletchley Park, you know, sort of code breaking.
Did she? I did not know that.
Exactly. A woman of many parts. Oh. So she's always interested in puzzles and strange things like that. Mm. And in this book, there's something called radionics. Apparently, there was a craze in the 50s for using kind of radio frequencies to affect people's behaviour. It was kind of like a sort of pseudoscience. They thought, oh, I could twiddle the knobs and at a distance cure someone or make them sick. She was obsessed with things like that.
Right. And her Bletchley Park experience, she was either not allowed to talk about it or didn't talk about it.
I don't think she talked about it much, but I think... Yeah, no, she didn't, as far as I know. I mean, she was very secretive. So she, at one stage, she actually had a biographer, official biographer, who started work on a great biography of Muriel Spark while she was alive. And Muriel Spark then cut him out, hated it, wouldn't have anything to do with him. Because she kept these archives of all her materials. She's one... You know how some people keep everything? She's one of those people.
Okay. When did she die?
Oh, gosh. There's a good question. She died in 2006. Right. I wrote that down.
So she was made a dame.
That's right.
She was celebrated.
Yes, definitely.
And she wrote Miss Jean Brodie.
The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie is probably her most famous.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of others. Memento Mori I read not so long ago, which, funnily enough, was turned into a film... with Dame Maggie Smith, who died recently. So yes, it was funny watching. It's worth, if you can obviously read the novel, which is strange, odd telephone calls in the middle of the night sort of saying, remember, you must die. Oh, good Lord. People hear different voices, though.
They hear different...
Yes, no, it's very strange, but funny as well, because it is actually it makes fun of old people.
Well, increasingly, I'm against no. that. There was a time when I thought that was perfectly reasonable, yeah. but I think not so sure.
If you look at iPlayer, I think you can find Memento Mori on it. Okay. I sort of found it not so long ago. Terrific film.
Okay, so the recommendation is?
So I think we do A Far Cry from Kensington.
Give it a whirl.
Yes.
The Great Muriel Spark. Thank you for that. What else have you got this week?
I'm going to also suggest, what else... I've been reading a book by Robert Douglas Fairhurst about how to read, which I was going to bring up with me, because now I realise I needed a prop. But it's a very good book about how to get most out of reading. So it will take... he's an Oxford don, literature don, but it'll take something like some Sally Rooney dialogue. You know how it's all that back and forth?
I wish someone would take some Sally Rooney dialogue.
But he shows actually how clever it is. Because you remember, there's no quote marks, and it's just, in a way, it's very flat. So it'll be like, Marianne says, yeah. Connell says.
I'm always being told that I'm just an old so-and-so, because I know my eldest daughter loves Sally Rooney, and she's always telling me, I just don't get it.
Bit of a generational gap, yeah. Which I'm on fall on the same side as you.
Okay.
But I can't...
What are we missing?
I think she captures... Something the way people talk. And I think this is the point Robert Douglas Fairhurst says. That kind of very... You know, if you overheard a conversation between people about something that matters, it's usually very flat, not very expressive. And the thing that they're really talking about is always, you know, off page. And you think of the most important conversations you've ever had in your life. Usually the thing itself is not said. It's usually dancing around it. So I think that's Sally Rooney's secret power is the dialogue. Now, if you pages and pages of it after a while, yeah, you can get a bit... Because I have to say, the millennials do like to talk about their feelings a lot.
Oh, yeah. Don't say yeah. anything
either. I give a little talk to any young staff about feelings that you sort of put them in the paper bag, you know, screw them up, push them down, and then if the feelings come back, you get some alcohol and pour it over.
Is that really serious? Is HR, can we...
It's not good advice, but it's my advice.
Do you know what I say to the young, Robbie? I just say, count your blessings. Yeah. What have you got to complain about?
No.
I'm hugely popular. You and I are very much of our generation, but you're right. Young people, they do. And Sally Rooney is a young person, and she's yes. harnessing that, and she yes. is, she's rather good at
definitely.
She's rather good at it.
I think yeah. she really sort of manages to break through all the noise and actually sort of, I think with novels you want someone that can almost, like an author, reach out from the page and kind of grab you by the hand and sort of saying, I'm talking to you and you kind of know this already, but I'm cleverer than you, but not in an arrogant way, and I'm going to sort of show you new feelings and
yeah.
tell you something about yourself.
This guide on reading,
yes.
surely you don't need that book, because presumably you read voraciously and quickly.
Well, do you know what? Sometimes you do, because someone's asked me, how many books do you read? And I say, well, that's a good question. But I always think that I could do a PhD... on the first 50 pages of the British novel 2013 to 2025. Mm-hmm. But often I can't go any further because I got to, you know, I'm reading it for a bit of taste to see who might, whether it's worth reviewing,
right.
who might be good to review it. And sometimes
that's what you do. Yeah, so
there's right. a lot of novels. I think no idea what happens after page 50. And then I can't remember whether I read them or not. So you're
going to really enjoy the reboot of Pride and Prejudice, aren't you? You'll be blown away.
but then I sort of probably read about 100 books properly from beginning to end a year.
Can I ask a question? I mean, I have found lately that I do feel now that I'm too old to carry on with a book I don't like.
Oh, yeah, you should be ruthless.
Okay.
Dump it.
That's
dump
all
it.
Right, is it?
Absolutely. Because sometimes, you know, the novelists... You read today and you're not getting into it, you know, hide it in a cupboard, get it out 2 years hence, and then all of a sudden it will make sense to you or will open up to you. For me, it was Nabokov's Lolita. I remember trying to read it years ago, and it was it's so baroque and rococo, and it's writing so frilly, too much, too much. And then I sort of read it a few years ago and think, Yes, this is a work of genius.
Okay, right. So sometimes it's worth rebooting it, going back to it when you're in the right frame of mind. Yeah. Right. I think we need one more. So that book is called?
And the book's called Look Closer, How to Get More Out of Reading by Robert Douglas Fairhurst.
Okay, and what else? Just one more.
One more. This, funny enough, I interviewed the author on stage at Cheltenham. It's called A Scandal in Königsberg by Christopher Clark. And Christopher Clark wrote a very big book, a huge hit called The Sleepwalkers, about the origins of the First World War. But here he's gone micro. It's just 150 pages long, this book. And it's about a scandal in Königsberg in about 1835. And already I can see your eyes glazing over, not thinking, that's boring. But it's not, because he stumbled across this story, fumbling through archives, and it was this idea that in this East in Königsberg, capital of East Prussia, some young women were supposed to have expired from sexual exhaustion because they were involved in a cult. So immediately, Christopher Clark's ears picked up a bit. It sounds interesting. And it was, he examined what had actually happened. And it was kind of like an earlier kind of media scandal. It was all confected. No women had died from sexual exertion. I think it's quite hard to make that happen.
Don't look at me.
But it was essentially two Lutheran ministers had developed a particularly good relationship with the women in their congregation. They did this amazing thing of talking to the women as human beings.
Oh, no.
And listening to them.
Well, that won't catch on.
No, that won't catch on. But it made a lot of men very nervous. These churchmen were kind of almost interfering in their private lives by listening to these women, talking to them, encouraging them to come up to make their own decisions. So it turns out to be quite a small subject, but in the end it becomes a very big theme about how the church treated women, the relationship of women at the times, how men spoke to women. So, you know, from this small story, a much bigger story emerges.
Okay, that sounds, okay. And that book is called?
A Scandal in Königsberg.
Right, by Christopher Clark.
That's right.
You've been told. Robbie Millen, who is literary editor of The Times and The Sunday Times, and fans of Robbie will be delighted to know that in the absence of Fee, Robbie is a part of the off-air podcast today alongside our producer colleague, Evelyn. And it's quite turned out to be rather a good trio, actually. Robbie was a very welcome addition. So that's off-air, available wherever you get your podcasts from, plummeting in your direction at around about 6 o'clock tonight. I should say that Helen says, I'm 75 and I love Sally Rooney's novels. Actually, she doesn't say love, she says she likes. I don't want to exaggerate. Thank you for that, Helen. So I think maybe it's just Robbie and I who are struggling with the collected works of Rooney. Sally, not Wayne. Right, Adam Shaw next. It's Jane and Fee without Fee today on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Times Radio Breakfast with Nationwide. Start your day with Times Radio's essential morning briefing. With intelligent conversation and incisive analysis from some of the most respected names in politics, culture and entertainment. Hear well-informed opinion and quality journalism on all the big stories making the headlines. Times Radio Breakfast, tomorrow morning from 6, with Nationwide, a good way to bank.
Download the free Times Radio app and listen to us wherever you are.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people who change that perspective. The curiosity that leads you to the edge of the earth and the joy that meets you there. Silversea brings you closer to the rare, the remote and the remarkable. On spacious yet intimate ships that show you what most miss. Here's to having every reason to celebrate. To finding more. Learn more at silversea.com.
Ah, claim approved. Direct Line's ready to send my new laptop within 2 hours. That's how it's done. Imagine if that's how everything got done. Like teaching little Johnny to play his recorder.
Oh my.
That's my boy!
Direct Line. That's how it's done.
Theft and accidental loss claims up to £3,000. Cover limits apply. Personal possessions cover needed for items outside the home.
Looking to grow your investments and generate a long-term income? The Scottish American Investment Company, also known as SAINTS, could help. Saints has been investing for over 150 years and focuses on growing capital as well as income by investing in a diverse range of companies from around the world. Saints is managed by Baillie Gifford, manager for some of the UK's best-known investment trusts. Find out key information and more at baillieGifford.com. As with any investment, capital is at risk and income is not guaranteed.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Adam Shaw is here. We always talk personal finance matters around this time on a Monday. And the UK's regulatory system for vets is apparently not fit for purpose, according to the competition watchdog. It found that vets are charging pet owners double the price of online pharmacies for prescription medicines. Average prices at vets rose 63% between 2016 and 2023, well above the rate of inflation. Well, yes, we'd be absolutely incandescent if inflation was running at 63%. Is pet insurance really necessary? How do you make sure you get the best deal? So, Adam, are you a pet owner?
I was a pet owner, not anymore.
I'm not intruding on grief. What a way to start the interview. I'm sorry.
But I tell you what I do do. I foster guide dogs. And if you want a pet, but don't want one for life sort of thing, there are schemes like that. So, for instance, guide dogs stay with me and you help train them and you stay overnight and they look after them on weekends, but you give them back at the end of 3 months.
Oh, how fantastic. So, and how old are they when they come to you?
I mean, they're not puppies.
No.
They've gone through their basic training, but they're young. They're in training. They're like kids. You have to take them to school each day and you have to pick them up from school. It's quite a commitment and you look after them. You're meant to be really strict with them at home so that they haven't learnt all these good behaviour and then sort of forgotten it at home.
Oh, I see. So you're not encouraged to pet them?
No, there's lots of... I'm not sure I'm very good at this, but things like, yes, they've got to be controlled because they will work in environments where perhaps dogs aren't particularly welcome.
Yeah.
So they've got to be subservient and everything. But it's nice to have a pet, and that's a way of having one without the big costs.
Yeah, I have to say, whenever I see a guide dog at work, I am so impressed. I mean, that is just something truly worth celebrating, isn't it?
Yeah, amazing.
Absolutely incredible. Okay, so tell us then about this. Well, it is a scandal, isn't it?
Well, it's very high prices are being charged here. And there's, I think things will move. Actually, I think the regulators are about to clamp down on this industry, perhaps not as strongly as people initially hoped. But I think we will probably see change early next year. One of the business issues, I mean, this isn't, doesn't affect individuals, obviously, but I think the reason perhaps we're here, it's similar to actually the structure, I think, of the funeral industry, in which you see lots of little, what look like family-owned funeral parlours, and you see lots of vets, but actually they're all owned, or most of them are owned, by big conglomerates.
Yeah.
So there's quite a lot of, not monopolistic power, but going that way. And that's why, I think partly why I've seen these price rises. There's less competition than it appears.
Okay, yes. So the idea of your local vet, it's not really true.
It may be owned by a large conglomerate.
But presumably you can find that out.
Yeah, it's not a secret at all.
No.
But it actually reduces competition. Because it looks like there's lots of players, and I think there are less players than we think there are.
Right. But presumably change, as you've indicated, is afoot.
Yes.
But in the meantime, you'd be mad, wouldn't you, not to have pet insurance?
Yeah.
Although, can I just mention a listener, James, I think pet insurance is a rip-off. You're better off putting the money into an ISA or a savings account. Inevitably, James has a story. I had a retriever who had a nasty ear infection and he needed surgery. It was caused when he dived into a pond to try and get a golf ball when he was five. The insurance didn't pay out because on his record was a slight ear infection as a puppy. Completely unrelated, and we didn't even claim for it. I paid for the antibiotics myself. I think they're sharks.
Well, this is very similar to the conversation we had last week about human health insurance.
It's true. Yeah.
And going, do you have to buy it? And one of the things I said was, I think it's a perfectly reasonable strategy to go, well, I'll take the money I would pay in premiums and I'll invest that separately and maybe that'll do well. And, you know, hopefully I won't need hospital treatment. And in the same way, hopefully your pet doesn't need that. So that's not a bad way. The problem with that strategy, as it is with humans, is that the cost of care is eye-wateringly expensive, or can be. And much more than the cost of buying the pet. So, for instance, I had a look. I mean, we always talk about cats and dogs.
Mm-hmm.
I had a look for a pet rabbit called Adam, and I searched for what it would cost me to buy this pet rabbit and what it would cost to insure. So £80 to buy, £200 a year to insure. And therefore, you see that what's actually costing money, these operations are very, very expensive.
Yeah.
And there's more and more involved. I mean, I suppose you could say that's a really good thing, that the insurance is covering more and more. So obviously, if you have an ear infection or an accident, but there are quite common now to have hydrotherapy or to have behavioural psychology.
Hydrotherapy for a rabbit?
Well, for pets. I didn't check in the hydrotherapy issue of my rabbit insurance. But there's lots covered. And indeed, sort of psychological behavioural issues can also be referred if recommended by the vet. And I think that's partly why, you know, because a lot of dogs, I think in particular, get separation anxiety. And, well, that can be treated. So I think what insurance companies are offering you large amounts of stuff, and that is costing a lot of money.
Right. I'm not going to name my insurer for my tabby cat, but I will say the year before last, I paid £213 a year to insure her. And last year, which, by the way, it runs out in 2 weeks.
Right.
I just realised, £250.
Right.
She's a little older. She's four. But she's never been ill in her life, as far as I can make out. I mean, am I being ripped off?
Well, you know, there's really emotive terms that are ripped off. I think you should, like with all insurance policies, look around now. And indeed, one of the things I think people get caught out by, you'll see a big thing like, oh, you have £20,000 worth of coverage a year. And you think, well, I'm never going to spend £20,000 in vet bills that year. But inside that, there'll often be inner limits. So they'll say £20,000 overall, but actually you can't claim for more than £3,000 for a cruciate ligament, for instance. And I looked this up, Fairer Finance has warned that a cruciate rupture, to be honest, I don't know what that is, but it's clearly something that often happens, costs about £4,500.
Yes.
Even though you've got £20,000 worth of coverage inside the policy, actually the limits are lower. So when you're looking around, Jane, next week... Do you look for those inner limits as well?
I hope Dora's not listening. Chris, I like this. Chris says, our cat, Barros, cost us £28,000 in vet fees during his decade.
Right.
Pet insurance turned out to be a fantastic investment.
Yes. Well, and that's why I think that's why people have it, because it's what I was saying, these things can be very expensive. And you get to a stage where if you don't have pet insurance, you're making some very hard decisions. If your animal, your pet is really ill and you say, well, I'm not going to spend £20,000, do you let that animal die? I mean, these are big calls to make. So that's why pet insurance is increasingly popular.
Does you might not know this, but does pet insurance pay for putting your animal down if they're suffering?
I'm not sure about that.
Because, I don't think it does.
Because it's not a sort of...
It's not a treatment as such.
It's not a treatment as such. I think those sorts of things. And it's not just, of course, insurance. If you're wanting to get a pet, there are lots of other costs involved. A PDSA, a charity, has a really good chart on what it costs actually just each year to have an animal. And I think that's worth looking at. There's also a couple of sites. If you want animals and can't all this expense, I don't know anyone who uses it, but there's, for instance, a site called Borrow My Doggy. And I think there are others where you can go, someone who has a dog and goes, well, you can have it for the day. And also, you've got, you know, if you're out at work, your cat's probably okay by herself, but if certainly dogs don't like being left by themselves all day, you shouldn't really be doing that. And therefore, you've got a doggy daycare. All these things are really expensive. Look into them before you start getting pets.
Very good advice. Thank you very much. More from Adam on his socials at AdamShawBiz and the website themoneydoctor.tv. Jan, thank you for your lovely message about your late husband and Coventry City. Saturday was his birthday, so it was extra special, says Jan, to hear about them on your programme this afternoon. It was unexpected. Jan, our pleasure. Have a lovely evening. Thank you for listening. John Pienaar next.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thanks, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar, and this is Times Radio Drive. Here are the headlines. The first person in the UK has been jailed for encouraging a child to self-harm under the Online Safety Act. And a revolutionary microchip implant has allowed people who'd completely lost their sight to read again. And coming up, as Donald Trump sends his Middle East top team to Israel, is peace in Gaza more fragile than ever? I'll talk to a former US peace negotiator in the region. And all the latest on the groundbreaking technology that's helping the blind to see, that's coming up. And this is After the News with Andy Hayes.
Thank you, John. Good afternoon. A married father of two has become the first person in the UK to be jailed for encouraging a child to self-harm under the Online Safety Act. Carl Davis, who's 42 and from the Wirral, has been given a 20-year sentence. He groomed the victim online when she was 13 before picking her up from school and abusing her. Zoe Becker from the Crown Prosecution Service says it was a difficult case to work on.
None of the cases that we deal with are easy, but when you have these cases where there are extensive chat histories and photographs being shared back and forth of not only kind of sexual images, but also in images of self-harm, it does take its toll.
Blind people have been able to read again after having a tiny microchip inserted into the back of their eyeball. Patients who were previously living in darkness took part in a trial with a team at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London. They can now recognise faces, do crosswords and read books. Hamas says the body of another Israeli hostage will be released at 6 p.m. UK time and says it was exhumed yesterday in Gaza. US Vice President J.D. Vance will travel to Israel tomorrow to try to shore up the Gaza peace deal. The ceasefire is still ongoing despite being heavily tested over the weekend. Israeli government spokeswoman Shosh Bedrosian has been updating reporters this afternoon.
Terrorists carried out an attack of multiple shootings, including an RPG and armed fire in multiple positions, killing two of our IDF soldiers. 16 deceased hostages are still in Gaza right now. Third, dozens of incidents of terrorists have crossed the yellow line.
Hamas says it is committed to the ceasefire. Benjamin Netanyahu has held talks today with US envoy Steve Witkoff and Donald Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner. Pizza Hut is to close 68 restaurants and 11 delivery sites after the company behind its UK venues fell into administration. More than 1,200 workers are being made redundant as part of the closures. The company that runs the global Pizza Hut business, Yum Brands, says it's bought the UK restaurants in a rescue deal that will save 64 sites around the UK. Prince Andrew's team has been accused of trying to hire internet trolls to hassle Virginia Giuffre. The claims have appeared in her posthumous memoirs, which are out tomorrow. The royal has always denied sexually abusing her. He has, though, renounced his honours and titles because of the ongoing scrutiny of his links to the convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The SNP's Westminster leader, Stephen Flynn, is calling for legislation to formally remove those titles altogether.
I'm sorry, but the weasel words of government ministers trying to hide behind the royal family does themselves an injustice. They are legislators. They are the ones who have the power to take action here, and they should be using that power.
And the son of former England footballer Stuart Pearce has been killed in a tractor crash. 21-year-old Harley Pearce is believed to have lost control of the vehicle in Gloucestershire on Thursday. His sister Chelsea says he was a golden boy with an infectious smile. And for a roundup of the news on demand, subscribe to the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. John Pienaar at Drive on Times Radio.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Drive on Times Radio. Thanks for joining me. Getting a ceasefire in Gaza was always the easy bit of the Middle East peace plan. And now, with President Trump's team in Israel to talk about the hard bit, running and rebuilding the place, it turns out that the easy bit, the ceasefire, is already hanging by a thread. Who'd have guessed it? Apart, I mean, from just about anyone who understands the region and the clear readiness on both sides to get back to fighting and killing. Donald Trump was asked on Air Force One last night about the situation in Gaza.
We want to make sure that it's going to be very peaceful with Hamas. And as you know, they've been quite rambunctious. They've been doing some shooting, and we think maybe the leadership isn't involved in that, you know, some rebels within. But either way, it's going to be handled properly. It's going to be handled toughly, but properly.
Is the ceasefire still in place?
Yeah, it is.
Well, in a moment, the latest for you from Gaza, and we'll try to weigh the chances of President Trump's envoys, Steve Witkoff, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, making progress in Israel, meaning get the whole thing back to the starting line of a steady ceasefire and then pointing the way towards some kind of stability. The clock is ticking before the soaring hopes and even higher-flying rhetoric of Donald Trump last week start to die away like a mocking echo. And a bit later, could Prince Andrew fall any further? Well, the answer is yes, apparently, and we'll talk about that too. Tell me what you're thinking. Send me a text, 87222. Start with the word Times or a tweet to @TimesRadio.
Firstly, Hamas has said it will return the body of one hostage at 6 p.m. this evening, as the week-old ceasefire with Israel appears more fragile than ever. Today, Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff met Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel after more than 28 people were killed in Gaza after a flare-up in which Palestinian attack killed two IDF soldiers at the weekend. First then, welcome to the programme, Tim Marshall, author of Prisoners of Geography. Tim, welcome as always.
Hello there, John.
Tim, I just mentioned the fragility of the Gaza ceasefire, which is something seasoned Middle East watchers like you warned us about, even as President Trump was trumpeting what he called his everlasting peace deal last week. Now, after the public executions by Hamas and the gunfire with the IDF, the IDF airstrikes reported to have killed dozens of Palestinians, does the Israeli leadership, Benjamin Netanyahu and his cabinet in particular, Tim, want to stop fighting and bombing? And do you believe that Hamas will relinquish its hold on Gaza?
Yes and no. Right. I think the Israeli cabinet would prefer, on their own terms, to stop if they believe that the whole Trump phase 1, 2, and 3 can go through. Hamas, everything we've seen at the moment suggests they don't want to. They're not ready to surrender yet. But I agree with you that the easy bit was getting this far, and the hard bit is getting to phase two. But there's two things that make me think that that is still on track, despite what happened on Sunday. Sunday morning, a Hamas unit appeared out of a tunnel complex. They fired some rocket-propelled grenades at an IDF unit, killed two, wounded several. The Israelis responded, and this is the important point, with airstrikes right across the Gaza Strip, killing, as you've said, at least 26 people. But the point is, they didn't go in anywhere on the ground. They stayed behind the yellow line. And I think that's the template they were saying to Hamas. You can do this to us. We will come in on the air. You're not going to, you know, get to us the way that you could. That's one thing. The second thing is more important. That's the clip you played from the president of the United States when he said, I don't even know if this was the Hamas leadership would signed off on it. Now, I doubt he knows one way or the other. But what he's doing there is saying, I'm not going to let this incident derail the progress that we hope has been made. Hence, you see Witkoff and Kushner arrive and or equally important, John, tomorrow, it's not still not confirmed, but it looks like Vice President Vance rocks into town. Now, the two previous guys are pretty tough. This guy is